You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Over the past few months, you've heard on this program complaints that
the rent is too damn high. The rent is too damn high.
And tenant protections are too damn weak.
I'm very, very worried that this is going to contribute to the inflow of people on our streets.
And tenant evictions happen too damn often.
The spotlight is back on an HGTV real estate star. A group of renters is accusing Tariq El Moussa of evicting them from their homes for a renovation project.
This has today, however, a story about the folks landlords are hiring to get tenants out of housing that is still affordable. For many property owners, rent control translates to lost profit, which is why some have been spending big bucks on professional re-tenanters, those who empty rent-controlled units so rents can be jacked up to market rate when everybody leaves. It's all part of a growing and lucrative tenant relocation business. Advocates say it's making L.A.'s housing crisis a lot worse. Reporter Jack Ross covered the issue for L.A. Public Press. You might recognize him also from reporting here on KCRW as well. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Break it down for us. What are tenant relocators? What exactly do they do?
Yeah, tenant relocators are companies or individuals who landlords are hiring to buy tenants out of their rent-controlled units. So they do the kind of interpersonal negotiations with tenants, convincing them, cajoling them, and allegedly, in many cases, threatening them to make tenants take money to leave their apartments so that landlords can convert those apartments to market rate. They can bring in a new tenant who will pay, you know, three or four times the price. So there's lots of complaints within tenant groups and the tenant union here in LA that there are these individuals who are showing up at their door who aren't necessarily building managers. They're not necessarily landlords themselves, but they're actually companies that landlords have hired to do the dirty work of convincing tenants to leave their homes, which in many cases, you know, they've lived in for decades.
Well, now there's a difference, Jack, between cajoling, convincing, and threatening, right?
Correct. Yeah. So there's basically a few things that happen here. You know, in many of these cases, what tenants allege is that a tenant relocator will show up, someone who looks, you know, charming, well-dressed, clean-cut, and they'll be offering a tenant money to leave their apartment while at the same time a landlord is deteriorating the conditions in the building itself. And what the tenants allege is an effort to make them leave. So, you know, services will be suspended, really brutal remodels will be ongoing so that tenants are living amongst construction and drilling. And then meanwhile, there's a friendly face who shows up at your door every so often, offering you tens of thousands of dollars to leave. And then oftentimes tenants will say that these people will show up and threaten them with deportation, or they'll tell them that their building is going to be torn down and that they have to leave or else they won't have anywhere to go. They don't have a choice. Or they'll tell them that, you know, everyone is taking buyouts but them, and there's a certain amount of money for buyouts. And if they don't take a buyout now, they'll end up with no money at all. So many of these relocators can be quite aggressive.
This is called cash for keys, right? Is that what this is?
Exactly, right. Yeah, that's the thing to understand here. So a cash for keys offer is when a landlord pays a tenant to leave their rent-controlled apartment. And once they do that, rent control is broken. They'll bring in someone who is willing to pay three or four times the rent at market rate and turn a really significant profit. Basically, you know, the windfall of flipping a unit from rent controlled to market rate is so significant that $100,000 to a landlord is actually, you know, that's a price worth paying to replace one tenant who's paying a certain amount with someone else who's paying quite a bit more.
So not only are they offering, right, or in cases that you mentioned, threatening or whatever, saying we'll give you this much money to the tenant, they're paying these re-tenanters to do the work on their behalf.
Exactly. So Shelby Istrin, who runs Onyx Relocation, which is a really prominent relocation company that I studied and covered in this article, Shelby charges landlords up to $10,000 per unit that she empties. Shelby only receives 3/4 of that fee after the occupants have signed an agreement and left the apartment. So what tenant groups say is that this is basically an incentive, a financial incentive to force tenants out of their homes by any means necessary, potentially.
I want to play this clip from a landlord webinar that was hosted by CEO Shelby Istrin, whom you talk about. And they're talking about dealing with tenants during the buyout process. Let's listen.
Even tenants who say they saw it coming are usually still dealing with a little shock. So give them a second, let them digest the offer, and just keep in mind that they might be emotional. For you, it's a business transaction, but for them, you know, you're buying out their home.
Business transaction versus, you know, buying out your home. You have to leave your home. What did you learn from this webinar about the tactics that landlords are using to buy people out?
I think that clip really gets at the heart of the situation, right? So Shelby Istrin spoke to landlords, a webinar for landlords she conducted in 2021, and she spoke really frankly about turning a profit off of people's homes. So it's a business model that's predicated on removing people from their homes for money, and she was really upfront about that. She said that tenant relocation is a game of chess.
As soon as you deliver that offer to the tenant, your game of chess has started, okay? And every move that you make is gonna cause them to make a move.
So she really kind of was billing this game of tenant relocation as one of strategy that was played for high stakes. So I say in my article, it's chess played for money, more typically associated with poker, because there's a ton of money on the line here.
I mean, it's one thing for someone to come to your door and say, hey, look, you know, I know you're in a rent-controlled unit, but we're gonna offer you this kind of money for you to leave, right? It's another thing to sort of triangulate you, right? So the nice person comes to the door, offers you this money, while at the same time all this work is going on and the noise and everything else, and then maybe the landlord is threatening you in some other way as well. I just wonder, number one, is it legal to do that, the triangulation part, for one? And number two, if you're in a rent-controlled unit, you don't have to leave, right? If it's a rent stabilization unit in the city of LA, you know, that checks all the boxes, you don't have to leave, right?
That's absolutely true. Rent-controlled tenants are under no obligation to take a cash for keys offer. This is a buyout offer. This is money they're being offered to leave their apartment. And if it doesn't make sense to them, which for many it doesn't, because renting another apartment in the city is so expensive that however much money you're given by your landlord to leave your current home, it's not enough to rent another place in LA, and people often end up leaving the city. Tenant relocation is a legal profession. You know, landlords are allowed to send agents on their behalf to negotiate buyouts with tenants. What they're not allowed to do is violate or break the tenant anti-harassment ordinance and basically harass tenants into taking buyouts. That is completely illegal. And what tenants allege is that's what's happening. So at this building in Silver Lake, which I wrote about in my article, the tenants say that they were being harassed by their landlord, who bought the building in 2020. So that there's a really, really brutal remodel occurring in the building where, you know, construction workers had ripped out parts of the walls and ceiling. There was jackhammering and drilling in the apartment every day, and people were still living there. They said they felt like their building was falling apart around them while they were still living there. And then meanwhile, Shelby Istrin of Onyx Relocation, her employees arrive in their apartment offering them money to leave. So what they say is that their landlord offered the stick of tenant harassment, and Shelby Istrin offered the carrot of the cash for keys buyout to make them leave their rent-controlled apartments so that they could flip it for profit. In March of 2022, the landlords even removed the roof of this building on Sunset Boulevard right before a major thunderstorm that flooded the building and collapsed one of the unit's ceilings, and then the tenant relocators returned to the apartment building offering money. And saying, you know, this is only going to get worse. Are you sure you don't want to take cash for keys now?
Wait. They said this is only going to get worse?
That the conditions in the building were only going to keep deteriorating as this really, really brutal remodel continued.
It almost sounds like the mob. You know, if you don't take our offer, you know, forget about flooding your apartment. Maybe something worse will happen.
Yeah. And many of these tenants across the city, when they talk about relocators, you know, it kind of sounds like something you'd hear in a mob movie, you know, shady characters coming to your door and saying you need to leave your apartment or else.
There's been a big push, Jack, by tenant groups against these kinds of tactics, obviously. What do advocates want to see changed? I mean, obviously be nicer and not take the roof off before a thunderstorm. That would be one thing, I'm sure. I mean, is there a policy shift that needs to happen? I mean, should the city be overseeing this more?
Well, so there's really one law that's responsible for this dynamic, and it's called Costa-Hawkins. It's a state law, and what it says is that if you convince a tenant to leave a rent-controlled apartment, you can then charge market rate for the next tenant. That unit is no longer rent-controlled. It becomes what they call vacancy decontrolled. And tenant groups say that that creates a financial incentive to remove rent-controlled tenants from their apartments by, again, whatever means necessary. So this is where tenant harassment becomes an industry, becomes an extremely lucrative for-profit industry. So if Costa-Hawkins were repealed and there's a ballot measure to repeal Costa-Hawkins on the 2024 state ballot, then cities and counties could institute laws that say, I don't care if you had a rent-controlled tenant leave a rent-controlled unit. That unit is still rent-controlled. You are not allowed to then charge 3-4 times the rent for the next person, and it would take away that profit motive.
But again, that's not on the ballot until more than a year from now.
Yeah, fall of 2024. It's also the third time that it's been on the ballot. It's been defeated twice at the state level after, you know, landlord lobbying groups spent really, really significant amounts of money opposing that repeal.
Jack Ross, you can read his new story about the tenant relocation industry over at LA Public Press. And of course, hear him right here on KCRW as well. Jack, thanks for coming on and talking with us about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Well, there is much more of Greater LA to come, including a visit to the Vintage Synthesizer Museum in Highland Park that'll take you on a sound excursion like you've never experienced before. But first, a word about connection and truth on this first day of our fall fundraiser. We'd like to know where you're coming from, literally. Where are you? West Side, East Side, El Monte, West Covina, South LA, Culver City, La Cañada? Where are you? Maybe the Magnificent Desert, Indio, La Quinta, Ventura. Wherever you are, we ask for your support at KCRW. Greater LA connects you to the people and places, of course, of Southern California, with truth and with spirit, with love or concern, with hope. You're why we do this every day. And wherever you are, if you listen to this radio station, you are family. You're one of us, and we'd like to know where home is. And by the way, KCRW champion Sheila Golden, representing Long Beach, the LBC, yeah, challenges you to donate today on behalf of your city or neighborhood by matching all donations up to $10,000. $20 a month becomes $40 a month. How about that? KCRW.com/join, represent, and contribute to the station that you call home. KCRW. Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on with Greater LA on KCRW, or should I say, Groovin' On. Ah, that's a sound bath. On wood floors in a room stacked floor to ceiling with synthesizers. People are meditating, they sit or lie on the ground. Welcome to the Vintage Synthesizer Museum in Highland Park.
I just want it to be a place where people can have fun and be creative and be productive. You know, I just want it to be something fun and positive for myself and others.
That's Lance Hill. Lance runs the Sound Bath and put together this massive collection of synthesizers you can find here. It's a museum, yeah, but it's also an event space. It's a studio, and it's all available to you if you care for a sound bath or you want to check out a rare keyboard. KCRW's PJ Shahamit paid a visit.
The Vintage Synthesizer Museum is home to more than 100 pieces of gear. Some visitors can't help but feel overwhelmed.
Within the first couple weeks, some dude walked in and he was like, wow. He's like, oh, I bet everybody says that when they walk in. And pretty much everyone did say wow when they walk in. The other thing that everyone says when they're getting started is, I don't know where to start.
Let's start with an Oberheim OBXA. That classic opening riff by Eddie Van Halen on the song Jump was played on an Oberheim OBXA synth, which is more than 40 years old at this point. The synthesizer has become increasingly desirable and expensive. Resale listings can start at $6,400. Lance has got one, and there are so many others in here too.
The Yamaha CS80, the Yamaha CS70M, the Gleeman Pentaphonic Clear, the Moog, Mini Moog, the Roland.
Unlike a traditional museum, this one's interactive. You can make an appointment to play and record by yourself or with a group, all starting at $60 an hour. Composer and performer Greg Kowalski has used both digital and analog synthesizers since the 90s. He says digital synths have come a long way since they first popped up more than 25 years ago. So what is it about playing the real thing that makes analog gear so desirable?
The sound, the analog warmth, the imperfection of the analog synths. You know, you have to turn them on and let them sit for like 30 minutes before you can play it so they can like tune up. And I love that about old analog synths. The imperfection for me is something I seek in a way.
When Lance, the guy that runs the museum, was growing up, 80s new wave was on heavy rotation. Bands like Depeche Mode and A Flock of Seagulls. Playing music and listening to techno were the first spark for his interest in synthesizers. And then, when he was in his early 20s, a friend loaned Lance a vintage Moog Prodigy.
The things that really sucked me in with the Moog Prodigy was just like how fluid it was. Like you could shift the filter or the oscillators, and it just sounds like so natural.
Lance was into it, and he found a new expensive hobby.
Up to that point, it was pretty much just like old Casio keyboards and effects pedals. It'd be like a few more years before I had any money and could afford a real synthesizer.
Lance pulled together his money, and after a few years, he was finally able to buy his first vintage analog synth, a Yamaha CS20M. He was able to buy it because it was broken.
I got it on Craigslist in the Bay Area. I found a repair person who was just like maybe a mile away, who was really good and really affordable.
The synth repair person he met turned out to be the key to his whole collection.
If it hadn't been for that relationship with that repair guy that developed, this wouldn't have happened.
After that, Lance started collecting, buying broken synths, and fixing them up.
Being able to like buy broken things and take them to him. And then also through the years, like learning some repair stuff myself made this financially possible for me.
His collection grew to the point where he had it stored in a West Oakland warehouse. At first, it was a space where he and his friends would play and record, but grew to the point where Lance wanted to open a studio. And so he did, in Oakland. Doors opened in 2013.
It just felt like it would be such an honor to do something cool in the Bay Area and like contribute something. And it seemed like a Bay Area thing, like a vintage synthesizer museum.
Which it was, kind of. Actually, most of the people coming through didn't live nearby. Julia Davis and Joaquin Pollock make up the band Pearl and the Oysters, and they loved the place when they discovered it on the trip from Florida.
A lot of studios in LA have incredible gear, you know, but the quantity of those vintage synths and the rarity of so many of them and they're in good shape. That's a super rare thing.
I think that immediacy of access to all these sounds is what is both very overwhelming at first, but at the same time, so inspiring.
The two settled in LA 3 years ago and traveled up to Oakland to record parts of their album, Coast to Coast. Eventually, the museum's building was going to be sold, and finding a new place to rent in the area wasn't affordable. People visiting from LA encouraged Lance to come down.
Everyone who came up from LA would be like, oh, if you were in LA, you'd have so much more business.
So he did. Lance moved the collection to Highland Park in October of 2021.
It just seemed to make so much sense that if I moved to LA, once I got established, I would have that tourist business again. But then I would also have the giant community of musicians in Los Angeles to draw from.
Now you can learn about the basics of synthesizers from one of Lance's workshops. You can hear some live music from local musicians at the Synthetarium. And of course, the sound bath. So far, it's been working out for the museum. Musicians like Kevin Parker and Damon Albarn have made their way over, and the space has been warmly received by the Highland Park community.
At least 50% of the people who come through here are like, oh yeah, I live down the street or like 10 blocks away. So much like neighborhood support, which is really encouraging, and it makes you happy that you ended up this spot.
Workshops, synthetariums, and sound baths happen every month at the museum. And anyone who wants to save a couple $1,000 and sound a little like Eddie Van Halen can book a time. For KCRW, I'm PJ Shahamat.
All right, for more information on how to book an appointment at the museum or any upcoming events, check out the website. Our website, kcrw.com/GLA. We really do appreciate you listening to Greater LA. And, you know, pledge now at kcrw.com/join. And thank you, thank you, thank you for your support. Even more now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Albert Einstein once said, "I never think of the future. It comes soon enough." But you do think of the future, and that future consists of even more computers and automation, climate challenges, and artificial intelligence. And like everyone else, artists are working through ideas about the future. Analia Saban has a new show called Synthetic Self, which explores a mix of AI, global warming, creativity, and general anxiety that technological advances have brought or are bringing to the world. Lindsay Preston Zappas is editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, and she has a look, a preview, if you will, of a two-gallery show that Analia is doing. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Steve.
She calls herself an art maker rather than an artist. So what's the story behind that?
I would say that Analia definitely has this analytic side to her. She, in many ways, to me, sort of almost operates like an inventor. You know, in appearance, her work is always changing. It's evolving. There's a lot of material exploration that is really central to her work. You know, I think she thinks a lot about how she can push a material to its extreme. So in the past, she's done things like weaving with paint, or how do you bend a piece of marble and what does that look like? You know, so really exploratory. So I think maybe that's sort of what she's getting at with thinking about art maker rather than artist. But recently, she's taking this playful inventiveness into how she works with various machines and technologies. So looping in things like laser and vinyl cutters, or even playing with AI, and thinking about how she can really push those technologies into experimental places to kind of assist her in this process of art making.
The show is in two galleries, as I mentioned, though. It's in two separate places. And one piece that appears in both galleries is this marble, again, back with the marble, marble computer fan. What is it about that piece? Tell us a little bit about it.
So yeah, I think Analia's really has always been interested in computer science, even almost went into computer science when she was younger, and coding, and the way that technology sort of infiltrates our lives, right? She often uses circuit boards in her work. And for this show, she's really honed in on this kind of symbol of a computer fan as this kind of like symbol of technological growth. And, you know, computer fans, they're such a dumb object in a lot of ways. They're so cheap. They're kind of throwaway, but also very necessary, you know, in everything from our computers we use at home to these massive servers that exist in the world that have to be cooled. So, you know, I think in the use of the fan, there's also something subtly in there too about climate change. You know, we think about wind as a renewable energy source. So there's kind of like this play on words there that she's doing, a little pun. And then, of course, you know, making this cheap plastic kind of throwaway thing out of marble, which is one of, you know, the most timeless art materials, right, that will outlive us all. So there's kind of an ironic play there, I think, with consumption and technology, but also kind of art history.
She also has these works, Lindsay, that are encaustic. Explain what encaustic, like encaustic painting, or what kind of work is that?
Encaustic is a very historical medium. So it's actually a process where they would mix pigment with wax. So it has a very thick, opaque feel to it. And, you know, a lot of painters now use oil or acrylic. So again, encaustic is kind of this historical material. But so she's been, again, playing materially, kind of testing encaustic for a while. And there are two different bodies of encaustic paintings in her shows. For one, she paints a kind of white layer of encaustic, and then over that, a black layer. And then she sort of carves into it to create these drawings that expose the layer underneath. And these pieces are massive, and they sort of trace the process of art making, things like making a landscape or a portrait, almost as if she was like programming an AI system how to do it. So thinking through all the decisions that are made along the way of making a landscape painting, thinking about the tools you're going to use, thinking about the lighting, how do I draw my signature? And she kind of charts that on a big flow chart.
It's almost like she's showing her work.
Exactly. Yeah. And kind of showing the under layer of it beneath. Yeah.
And then you see the texture too, right? With the wax and the paint as well.
Exactly. And, you know, she's pushing that even more in the second body of work where she uses encaustic, and she covers it then in graphite and actually places the whole panel into a laser cutter and tells this machine to carve an image into the panel. And so it's this really strange way of kind of making a photographic image. And for many of these in the exhibition, she actually worked with AI software to create these unlikely images like mugs with multiple handles or these kind of uncanny AI self-portraits. So again, I think she's really pushing the boundaries of materiality and kind of conceptually thinking through technology and AI and how it kind of impacts us on a daily basis.
Lindsay Preston Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review LA. Lindsay, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, the people at one Jewish drug and alcohol rehab facility, Beit Challah, is a fundraiser. You're going to hear more about that coming up tomorrow. By the way, it is today, the very first day of KCRW's Fall Pledge Drive. All we ask is that you give now to keep KCRW strong for years to come and represent your neighborhood or your city, your area code. KCRW champion Sheila Golden, representing Long Beach, is matching every donation up to $10,000 when you tell us where you're listening from. Represent your neighborhood with a donation to KCRW. It's at kcrw.com/join. And of course, thank you, thank you, thank you for your support. And check us out anytime online, kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, Evan Ray, and Christian Bordahl all helped run today's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your support this evening. Have a great night.